first item on our agenda today is House Bill 2710. So folks that are here to testify today, welcome. I know a lot of you here are anxious to testify on one of the three bills that we have for public hearing today. I'm going to do 2710 first, and I'm going to try to get through that in half an hour, 45 minutes or so. And then Representative Holby is going to present his bill that suggests reforms for the Oregon Department of Energy. And then I'm going to move on to House Bill 2669, and we'll have a presentation by the sponsors of that bill. And just so you know, folks, we are very pressed for time. I would appreciate it if everybody could keep their comments to about 2 minutes. Some of our presenters, the initial panels, have things to describe. They will go a little bit longer. But we will push up against the end of the hearing time today. My committee members have lives to lead and may have other things to do, and they may disperse at about 4:45. But I will stay on and take your testimony for at least another hour, and so that everybody that has traveled and come to talk will have an opportunity to do so. So it may take a little bit of time to get to you, but I will listen to you, and we'll get your testimony into our record. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2710 and invite Jim Edelson, Anthony Roy, and Christine Lewis up. As soon as you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Jim Edelson. I am the Director of Codes and Policy at New Buildings Institute, a national nonprofit organization headquartered in Portland. I was a member of Oregon's Commercial Energy Committee, Advisory Committee in 2009 and 2010. I'm currently a voting member of the Standing Project Committee for the nation's High Performance Model Building Standard, ASHRAE 189.1. In my 2009 testimony before this body, I emphasized that Senate Bill 79 set in motion a clear direction for the state to reduce energy use in buildings by 15% for the 2011 code and set forth a path through 2030 for buildings to help meet the greenhouse goals that this legislature set in 2007. Fortunately, SB 79 passed the legislature by a wide margin and was signed into law by Governor Kulongoski. The agencies met their first mandate of the 15% goal, and that was the good news. On the other hand, Oregon's energy code has virtually stalled since then for a period of about 6 years. The consequences are threefold. One, Oregon is now well behind its 2030 code objective set forth in SB 79. Two, the Oregon Energy Code stands in the way of many Oregon cities, and you'll hear more about this later from cities, that must reduce their building sector emissions to meet climate action plans. Unlike most other states, Oregon cities are prohibited by statute from adopting their own energy code. Three, Oregon has fallen behind its peer states on the West Coast, all of whose governors agree to the goals of the Pacific Coast Collaborative. Please note that those PCC goals provide the basis for the 2032 goal you will see in HB 2710. So while Oregon has stalled, both California and Washington have fully kept pace with their obligations. Using DOE and Washington State data, we estimate that commercial buildings built in 2017 in Washington will, on average, use 17% less energy than those built in Oregon. For California, single-family homes built to 2016 standards will use about 28% less energy than their 2013 standards. So remember, while this 28% progress in California and 17% progress in Washington is occurring on the ground, progress in Oregon has stalled. And it's not just our neighbors on the West Coast. According to the Department of Energy, Oregon codes have now fallen behind such states as Utah and Alabama. And even Governor Chris Christie himself approved the 2015 IECC Energy Code in New Jersey, a full 2 years ahead of Oregon, maybe even 3 years, depending on how fast the department moves. So legislatures across the country have mandated regular increases in energy codes in their states. But in the 8 years since Senate Bill 79, Oregon consumers can no longer be assured that their homes and their buildings are up to national energy standards. This is a shame, but with HB 2710, the legislature can set the state energy code agenda once again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Helm and members of the committee, my name is Anthony Roy. I'm with Earth Advantage, an Oregon nonprofit organization that supports the building industry to provide research, training, and building certifications. Over the last decade, we have certified over 15,000 Oregon home and apartments to above code energy and environmental standards. Our team of consultants works with local builders and developers on a daily basis, helping them to build more efficient, more durable, and healthier buildings. Our team is close to the ground and understands the challenges that builders face. We believe that HB 2710 is an important step forward for three key reasons. First, in 2009, the legislature tied energy code developments to state climate goals through SB 79. The legislature took action to require that the state set goals for energy efficiency through state building codes and to consider aligning those goals with net zero energy construction targets. But those steps haven't happened. HB 2710 fixes this problem. Second, HB 2710 creates a clear yet flexible pathway for improving Oregon's building stock over time. It outlines a trajectory for regular incremental decrease in energy use of newly constructed homes and buildings over the next 15 years. Third, HB 2710 does not alter the code development or approval process currently in place in Oregon. What it does is set a fixed future outcome that participants in the code development approval process can collectively steer toward, while also letting them work out the technical details every 3 years on the best and least costly way to achieve each incremental step. The question of increased cost is always the first thing that is asked when energy codes are discussed. Earth Advantage recently did an analysis of the incremental first cost of the initial code improvement steps that would need to be taken to achieve the ultimate year 2032 energy efficiency goal. What we found was that homes achieving 20% better energy efficiency than required by current energy code were only about 2% more expensive to build today. This relatively small incremental cost difference is borne out in the market share of homes that are already voluntarily being built to 20% above, but 20% better than code level. Currently, around 40% of the homes built in Oregon are participating in above code energy efficiency programs like those managed by Energy Trust of Oregon. These builders are already building, on average, 20% more efficient than code requires. Another way to think of this current market reality, almost one half of the residential construction market is already one third of the way to the targets that HB 2710 sets to achieve 15 years from now. As standards progress, we feel confident that the Oregon construction industry will find ways to maximize efficiency methods. Oregon's designers and builders have a strong history of innovating. We see it every day. We know these professionals have the capability to continue creating more efficient housing, and the ultimate beneficiary will be the hundreds of thousands of future Oregon renters and home buyers who will be spending less of their monthly paycheck to cover their energy cost. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hallman and members of the committee, my name is Christine Lewis. I'm here with the City of Portland. Our Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has submitted a letter on OLIS, which will help fill out the remarks I will try and share briefly with you now. The City of Portland is strongly in support of 2710 with the -2 amendments. Practical energy policies like these are critical not only to reducing our energy costs, but also in supporting our local clean energy jobs, particularly in the Portland area. These policies take a responsible and measured action to respond to the urgent threat of climate change. The City of Portland, along with Multnomah County, has operated under a climate action plan that we've been working under since 2001. We updated it about 2 years ago in 2015. So our most recent measures show that buildings and the energy supply to buildings account for more than 40% of localized carbon pollution, and that the transportation sector brings up an additional 40%. This bill makes key contributions to addressing both of these sectors. For buildings, Oregon's statewide building code pioneered energy efficiency specifications for decades, making Oregon a national leader and saving residents and businesses hundreds of millions of dollars. But our code has not been improved since 2009, and we now lag well behind. It's important that we provide certainty to the development community about the direction and pace of improvements to the building code, and this bill establishes a clear level of performance to be achieved over the next 15 years. That's important to note. And then for transportation, Portland welcomes the amendment to ensure that new buildings include conduit and electrical capacity to allow for lower cost installation of electric vehicle chargers as the EV market continues to mature. So again, there's further comment on OLIS, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very
much. Oh, yeah. Oh.
Try and move ahead quickly. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Thank you all for being here. I guess as someone who actually works with building codes in my non-legislative life, I guess it makes me a little anxious to think that this body is going to start implementing building codes. I mean, where do we draw the line? We start talking about structural codes. There's a process outlined through the building codes division that's a very carefully orchestrated, regular, predictable process. And for the legislature to simply jump in here and start mandating a 65% reduction in energy use in new construction seems to me to be a real overreach. So any one of you can respond to that if you would care to.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. I'd first respond that other states are doing this, have done this, and are where the legislatures have set clear and precise goals at net zero in 2031 and 2032. And I would also add that other states, the legislatures, as I mentioned in my testimony, have set that state mandate regular upgrades, and that's one thing this state is lacking, and that's one reason we've fallen behind, because legislature has not made. And I want to refer you to the report from the Oregon Global Warming Commission, which one of its prime recommendations is that the agencies report to the governor and the legislature about their progress, because they recognize this is one of the prime barriers where the agencies are not keeping up with the pace that's necessary. And yes.
One more. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, we're struggling to meet the challenges presented by not having enough affordable housing. And so it's great to talk about increases in or decreases in the cost of utilities, but it's quite another to make sure that someone has a house to enjoy while they're worrying about those utilities. So the question I would have is, where are the studies that suggest how much more housing is going to cost as a result of these suggestions? And I don't want an opinion. There must be studies that show that if we do this, housing will cost this much more. And I don't want to hear about savings, because I'm worried about houses. Utility bills are great, but what I see happening in many of the discussions we have here in this building is a loading up of cost, horribly regressive costs, on people that can't afford housing or fuel or other things. I'm just very worried that this suggestion is horribly regressive. So you can answer if you have the facts, but I would sure like to see the studies. So if you can refer me to them, that would be great.
Yeah, the one comment I would make is that some of the leading practitioners in building to the standards that HB 2710 has stated are doing this right now, and they're low-income affordable housing developers, and you'll probably hear from them later, because they see that, you know, over the long-term ownership of that building, they're actually be able to put that money back into their investments to create more housing. So not only are the tenants paying lower bills, but the operational costs for that affordable housing provider is decreased, and they can invest that money back into additional units.
Follow-up would simply be, I look forward to that testimony.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christine, right? You mentioned that that the building codes have not been updated until 2009, but wasn't there significant increases in efficiency codes in 2011?
I'm going to probably need to get back to you on that. If there's an error in my testimony, I will correct it.
Chair?
Right.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So Senate Bill 79 was passed by the 2000 legislature, and what SB 79 mandated was that in the next building code cycle that the state agency should update it by at least 15% for commercial and 10% for residential. And that code was the 2011 Oregon code. So the 2009 was the last time the legislature touched the issue. 2011 was when the agency completed the instructions by the legislature. So it's been the 6 years since 2011.
Thank you very much. I'm going to move along. Thanks for your testimony. We appreciate it. Next is Renee, Rob, and Alex. We're going to try to get Rob Roy, with a great name, on the phone. Or are we?
No problem here.
The main cook kicked the cord. Go right ahead.
Sorry. Okay. Hello, my name is Renee Loveland, and I am with Girding Edlund. We are a commercial real estate development firm that specializes in investment management and property management, in addition to our development work. We're a 20-year-old company based in Portland, and we have done a number of projects in, obviously, in Oregon, but also in California and Washington, and have expanded into the Boston and Chicago markets as well within the past 7 years. We've developed or redeveloped over 75 LEED certified properties since 2000, and with the exception of five of those projects, they are all gold and platinum certified. Our principles in place articulate our firm's values, which include minimizing our carbon footprint and energy dependence and encouraging transportation alternatives. We support HB 2710, which asks for an incremental approach to reducing carbon emissions and increasing energy efficiency for new construction in Oregon over the next 15 years. Today, we are able to achieve a 15 to 25% improvement over code at little to no additional cost for our commercial and multifamily properties. The availability of better technology and the design community's familiarity with an integrative design process has made it more cost-effective to achieve higher levels of performance than it was 15 years ago. In Washington and California, where codes are more stringent than in Oregon, our savings tend to be in the 10 to 15% range. Those are typically our 5-over-1 sort of mid-rise projects. That said, we also have currently a high-rise multifamily building that is being that just is breaking ground in Oakland that is 50% better than Title 24, which is obviously more stringent than Oregon code. We believe financial incentives, such as those through the Energy Trust of Oregon, should continue to be available for those who lead the market. This will fuel the innovation that is necessary to be able to achieve increasingly higher levels of performance over time. In our work, we see that more and more investors are looking for assets that hedge risks associated with carbon emissions and rising utility costs. Better performing buildings are viewed as higher quality assets, and they fetch higher values at sale and are more desirable to tenants. Raising the floor of building performance is necessary to bring along the portion of the market that will not otherwise be motivated to change the way that they design and build. Incentives alone are not enough to move at the pace necessary to meet our climate policy objectives. Our building energy codes play an important role in charting a path for the kind of future we want for our state. Thank you.
Thank you. We're just going to dial a number here, and then I'm going to get to your testimony.
Hi, this is Rob.
Hi, Rob. If you can just hold on for one moment, you'll be testifying next. Thank you.
Right ahead.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the 2710 bill. My name is Alexander Wurzel. I'm with Greenhammer. We're a Portland builder in predominantly working in the Portland area and in the Medford area, mostly single-family homes. And we've been on the forefront of high-performance building for like 10 years. In fact, currently most of our new construction projects today actually already meet the net zero energy standard. So what we can show is that it's achievable, and there's a market demand for these kind of projects. People understand that not only utility savings are going to make up some of the incremental costs, but durability, comfort, and health in the building, protecting the investment long term, is recognized by many clients. So an increasing the energy code by 10 to 20% would result probably like in a small increase in construction costs. But like we heard before, it's obvious that it will be made up within a reasonable amount of time in terms of payback and utility savings, which at that point would be actually a net gain. So what the bill does, it protects, besides the innovation that we would show in Oregon, it protects homeowner long term economically. So even if the first cost is higher than originally anticipated.
Thank you. Rob, this is
Rob.
This is Representative Ken Helm, and we are ready for your testimony if you're ready.
Thank you very much. I am. Yes, this is Rob Roy calling from Bend, Oregon. I represent Pacific Crest Affordable Housing. We have built multiple units here in Central Oregon. Most of my comments will be specifically about Iron Horse Lodge, which is built in Prineville, Oregon, which we completed in 2016. It is a senior affordable housing project financed by Oregon Housing and Community Services, 26 units, roughly 27,500 square feet, and serving seniors between 60 and 20% of their median income. I'll go to the prepared text now.
Go ahead.
We built Iron Horse Lodge in 2016 to a level that uses 77% less energy than required by the current code. So it already exceeds what this legislation proposes to be the norm 15 years from now. Based on our experience, it is clear to us that multifamily projects can be built 20 or even 25% more energy efficient than current code with minimal increased capital cost. These energy saving measures alone can reach those levels in combination. More LED lighting, especially with lighting controls. More ceiling insulation, especially when combined with high heel height truss design. And more thermal breaks, especially with staggered double stud walls. These products and techniques are already on the market. Our low-income tenants are the biggest winners. Their fixed monthly rental payments include all utilities, including electricity and gas. They pay less for their housing, that is rent plus utilities, than they would pay at other affordable low-income housing units in Crook County because of our energy-saving and energy-generating measures. We made the decision to go big on energy efficiency and solar because it is the most sustainable approach to the long-term financial viability and our ownership of the building. By minimizing energy use and reducing energy costs that will only increase over time, we are better able to keep our rents low for longer while improving our building's bottom line compared to if we had built to minimum code standards. The increased cost of building these measures, when rolled into our permanent loan, is significantly less per month than what we are saving per month on energy costs. That's even after reaching 77% less energy than current code. So it was a win from day one. I'll just add one or two financial metrics, and then that's the end of the prepared text. The break-even on these measures is 6 years. And for those that know a little bit about net present value and life cycle analysis, the value of what we did in today's dollars is $666,000. And on that, I'll end my testimony. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
I had one here.
Rep. Resch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying. I didn't catch your name again. It was
Renee Loveland.
Ms. Loveland, thank you. You mentioned about Oakland in a building being 50% more. What was in your testimony? It was 50% more efficient, or?
Yes, than Title 24.
Okay, and then you mentioned also, I think, or maybe it was the gentleman next, you mentioned about investors wanting to buy buildings that have these building standards in them. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my question is, why do we need to mandate this? It seems like the market's already moving there.
I think that there are leaders in the market, and I think that those leaders have shown that there is a way to do this that doesn't just involve additional costs from a hard cost standpoint, but it's also a process. It's the way that you go about designing your building, working with your consultants in a very integrative fashion so that you're squeezing out all the economies that you can, investing in your facade, saving money on your HVAC system. I think that's a somewhat sophisticated process still for a lot of the market. And I think until we sort of raise the floor a little bit, we're not going to see that move the degree that we need to as quickly as we need to.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Rob, thank you very much for calling in today. We appreciate your testimony. Next, I'll invite up Nathan Phillips and Mick Goodrich, and I think Kurt Wilson. I'll get you up here too. And thanks everybody so far for having a concise testimony. We're doing okay on our schedule. Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Helm and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Phillips, and I'm here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I've been a contractor and a developer in Oregon for more than 35 years and have extensive experience working in code development in Oregon and nationally. In fact, in addition to chairing Code Making Panel 5 of the National Electric Code, I recently chaired the technical committee that completed formulating the Oregon Electrical Specialty Code based on the 2017 National Electric Code for adoption on October 1st. This is the fifth three-year electrical code adoption cycle that I've chaired in Oregon. I was also chair of the Oregon Electrical and Elevator Board and a member for 13 years. NECA has been a driving force in improvements in energy efficiency code for decades and takes great pride in the fact that our work has positioned the state of Oregon as a national leader in our building code system. I think you all have a copy of this report from the American Council of Energy Efficiency Economies that shows that Oregon's building code is in the top few states in the U.S. The goal of continuous improvement in the energy efficiency standards for the construction of buildings is laudable, and in Oregon is already achievable under the current regulatory structure if proponents would only make use of it. We believe in aggressive codes, but it's vitally important that any building code be clear, consistent, statewide, and prescriptive. In other words, that it's possible to comply with it all across the state. That's why these codes need to be written by energy industry professionals that make up the boards. And it's the Oregon Energy Efficiency Specialty Code was updated in 2014. Here's the 2014 code. And it is currently in revision. The 2017 code is slated, I think, for adoption on October 1st with the electrical code and other codes. At best, this bill is a solution in search of a problem because our state still receives high marks for energy efficiency codes. At worst, it's an effort to put in statute a system that essentially mandates unknown methods to meet arbitrary and abstract goals that may not actually result in reductions in energy use in buildings while having a profoundly chilling effect on Oregon's economy. This bill would seriously undermine the quality of our codes by injecting subjective performance-based requirements dependent on how end users use facilities, which are outside the control of contractors and developers. Prescriptive codes can and do contain provisions that increase the likelihood of continuous and proper use of state-of-the-art HVAC and lighting systems. performance-based codes do not include those requirements. Another major factor that affects energy use in buildings is the tools and equipment put in service by the occupants. Consider, for example, large industrial manufacturing occupancies or commercial settings such as restaurants, which can be energy intensive. The biggest share of the energy use comes from the equipment that the users bring into the building, not the things that are in the built environment. This change in focus from prescriptive construction codes to post-construction usage might seem like a small detail to people who don't work in construction every day, but this change alone would upend the very nature of our prescriptive codes, which is what currently provides predictability for contractors and developers. Under this new proposed model, how is code compliance to be determined? As stated earlier, we are in the middle of the code development process for the 2017 Oregon Electrical Specialty Code. The code was open for proposals for several months, and we had six open public meetings. During that process, we received one proposal from proponents of this bill, whose basic premise seems to be that the existing code development system does not provide adequate opportunity to improve Oregon's building code. We believe that proponents should at least have to see if they can accomplish their goals within the existing legal framework before they seek to get redress from the legislature to change the law. The one proposal that we did receive was from Representative Barnhart on electrical vehicles and providing infrastructure for them. The committee acted favorably on that, and it will be brought to the Oregon Electrical and Elevator Board on October 1st for action and is currently slated for implementation on October 1st. So we were surprised to see that in the -2 amendments, considering that we've already considered it and agreed to it. So as Representative Barnhart knows, I was inspired by him to add his recommended provisions in a development project of my own in Eugene. NECA and a broad cross-section of the construction industry strongly oppose House Bill 2710 because it seeks to impose an arbitrary one-size-fits-all goal through a method that creates unpredictable construction standards and unknown enforcement mechanisms. We encourage those who seek to improve the efficiency of Oregon's buildings to work with us and to bring their ideas to the existing open code development process. Thank you, Representative Feldman.
Thank you. Thank you. I just have to remind folks I'm trying to get testimony in about 3 minutes from our panelists, so do your best.
I can keep it short, I think. Chair Helm and representatives, thank you. My name is Mike Goodrich. I work for Legend Homes. I'm a single-family residential home builder. I've been building homes in Oregon for about 30 years. I'm a State of Oregon licensed master builder. I spent two terms on the Residential Structures Board, chaired the Construction Industry Energy Committee in 2011, and when we did update the energy code at that time. And I currently chair the Code Adoption Committee for the Residential Structures Board, for the upcoming Oregon Residential Structures Specialty Code. And I'm president of the Oregon Homeowners Association. So I come to you today to speak from the perspective of a home builder and someone who's been a longtime volunteer involved in the code process. I ask you to please use extreme care when interfering with the code process. I've had enough time involved in the process that I can tell you that it is complex. That your team at the Building Codes Division does an excellent job of bringing together stakeholders and thoroughly researching issues and looking at them from a broad perspective. And while energy use is an important concern, and energy efficiency is laudable and something that my own company aspires to go at a level above and beyond code. In fact, my own company uses the ETO EPS scoring program, and we guarantee the results of that program to our buyers for 3 years in order to provide them some assurances to their monthly bills going forward. So we're confident that, and I agree with the previous speakers, that things are moving forward in the way of energy efficiency in Oregon and in construction practices, and here is my concern. When I look at energy efficiency as a company, it's part of the things that I need to do properly to construct a home for someone. And so with Legend Homes, energy efficiency is a leg of that stool, as is durability, so the longevity of that structure, as is the health and safety of that home, as is the affordability of that home. And so my concern is when we legislate things like one leg of that stool, that we have the tendency to tip other legs off balance. And I would remind this well, I don't need to remind anybody, but I'd ask that we not repeat the days of the Construction Claims Task Force. And those of you that were around when we had numerous home failures in Oregon years ago may recall that parts of that were due to some pretty good ideas with vapor barriers and with air sealing, but we failed at implementation industry-wide with issues like ventilation and other components of the system that led to widespread failures. So I ask that that we leave this kind of work with the professionals at the Building Codes Division and with the volunteer boards that they've created and the stakeholders.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kurt Wilson. I live in Eugene, and I'm one of the managing partners of Pivot Architecture, a Eugene-based architectural and interior design firm that works throughout Oregon. I also serve as the Vice President of Legislative Affairs for AIA Oregon, that's American Institute of Architects, and I'm here to discuss the impacts of energy standards on buildings. In the interest of time, I'm going to cut out some of my comments because some of them have been repeated, but I want to say a few things. AIA Oregon adopted position on the energy code and on all building codes that they should be developed through a deliberate process with an understanding of the implications. They should be tied to a national model. And in the case of energy codes, we should exceed the national standard by a reasonable amount. House Bill 2170 sets a standard for energy usage by 2032, but is lacking in detail. Another bill was introduced this session, House Bill 2239, that established a task force to develop a comprehensive approach to code standards in Oregon, and we support that deliberate approach. It is widely understood in the design and construction fields that buildings consume about 40% of the energy consumed in the United States. Energy efficiency in buildings is obviously an opportunity to reduce energy consumption and impact climate change. However, there are vastly more existing buildings than new. Therefore, establishing policies, which should include incentives to upgrade existing buildings, is the most effective approach to address overall energy use. The energy code for Oregon for new buildings in Oregon is already reasonably high. However, many architects believe it can be higher. How much higher remains an open question. Therefore, a group of industry experts, including manufacturers' representatives, should be brought together to work this out. There are three basic design and engineering elements that comprise our response to the energy code. The parts of the building that consume energy, such as mechanical equipment and lights, which are typically products, the wall, roof, and floor assemblies that keep the buildings warm in the winter and cool in the summer, and the incorporation of energy renewable energy technologies such as solar panels. High performance in the products that go into our buildings is impacted by the markets those products serve. So we can't assume that higher standards in Oregon will be satisfied by higher product performance standards. Renewable energy technology advancements have been frustrating over the past 10 years, and we know there will be less federal support over the next 4 years. Therefore, it is difficult to assume more energy, renewable energy will offset energy consumption. That leaves the construction of walls, roofs, floors as elements that can be designed to a higher standard. However, we already have high standards. And much higher standards run the risk of legislating out common building construction systems. In my opinion, this is the greatest risk of the bill, and we could create rising construction costs, which will significantly impact what's built in Oregon. We need to replace schools. We need to build new fire stations, police stations, and hospitals to create a more resilient Oregon. Construction is expensive. It's getting more expensive, and I worry that we'll see less projects as construction costs rise. Turner Construction publishes construction cost data on a quarterly basis, and their research shows construction costs have grown at a rate of inflation much higher than inflation in the general economy. My firm, which currently has 25 people, down from about mid-30s a few years ago, has had less projects moving forward. The primary reason for that is the increase in construction cost. As with many architects and engineers in Oregon, a large percentage of our work is from the public sector, which we expect will do less this coming biennium than the last. AIA Oregon is concerned about our energy code, and we're concerned about climate change, but we're also concerned about the unintended consequences of this bill. I encourage you to support a deliberate process of upgrading energy standards in Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions for this panel? briefly. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I appreciate all you for being here. I just wanted to clarify something. A previous panel was talking about net zero as a goal related to this bill, but I think you would agree with me that net zero involves a lot more than just energy efficiency. You know, it's a point-based system that awards points for the origin of the lumber used in the project. It gives you points for whether you have bike racks accessible. It's a behavioral modification tool in addition to having some enhanced, either energy production and or efficiencies. Could you just talk about that?
If I could clarify, net zero is the goal of your building using less energy and generating its own energy so that the total amount nets out to zero. It's all about energy consumption.
But it's a point
the point-based system that you're referring to, sir, is the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED standard, which is a broader goal for overall sustainability, which is fundamentally different than energy efficiency. So I think one of my points was that, well, I think net zero is an important goal, and we need to be working towards that. It requires a level of and renewable energy technology, including higher performing solar panels, better performing battery systems, and other technologies that aren't quite there yet. And we can't, in and of ourselves, create standards that are going to get us there. And so we fit into a broader system.
I really need to move on. Thank you for your testimony.
I really.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate your testimony.
I'm going to invite up at this time Claudia Keith, Tracy Roten, and Samuel Pastrick. Okay. Welcome, and whoever's ready can start. And again, I'm really getting pressed for time, so as concise as you can possibly be would be helpful to me. Go ahead. Claudia, why don't you start?
Chair Helm and committee members, I'm Claudia Keith, speaking for the League of Women Voters, testifying with comments on House Bill 2710, topic relating to energy efficiency building codes. Please refer to my written testimony posted today, the League's testimony. our House Bill 2020 testimony, 2710 testimony, considers the League's national positions, and that's to preserve the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the ecosystem, with a focus on demanding pollution prevention, assuring justice and public safety for all people, and the League's Amici standings supporting our Children's Trust state and federal lawsuits relating to the public trust doctrine and a new fundamental right to a safe climate. The League supports accelerated, comprehensive, overall systems to begin to integrate the Oregon climate policy, which addresses energy, transportation, land use, building codes, and affordable housing planning, including appropriate siting, and which ensures our greenhouse gas emission targets are achieved in partnership with our regional partners. We support bills addressing improvement of residential and commercial building codes to ensure our building codes help meet the above stated greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. Oregon could optimally follow the net zero energy building code example that begins to take effect in California in 2020. This testimony recognizes that the greatest environmental moral challenge facing us at this time is climate disruption. There is an urgency, according to current science, to reduce net greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to avoid serious damage to the global climate ecosystem. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Power and Johnson, I apologize for my poor handwriting. For the record, my name is Samuel Pastrick. I'm a consumer advocate with Oregon Citizens Utility Board. I'm here today to express CUB's strong support for House Bill 2710 with -2 amendments. CUB is a statewide advocacy organization for residential customers of investor-owned energy and telecommunications utilities. We intervene on behalf of ratepayers before the Oregon PUC and represent their interests in front of you folks in the legislature. Projections for Oregon's new housing stock present an important and significant opportunity for economic and environmental benefits from energy efficiency. Buildings that meet energy efficiency goals up front benefit both the individual resident and the energy system on the whole. Plainly, this approach is just more cost-effective than renovating buildings down the line to meet what would be evolving energy efficiency goals. I'd also like to highlight lower energy bills, improvements in indoor air quality, and reduced carbon impacts. CUB is particularly pleased to support Section 2 of the bill related to facilitating electric vehicle charging. And in light of this, we are interested in joining any future discussions related to possible adjustments that would help EV users and yield electrical system benefits to support ratepayers. Thanks for your time and consideration of my testimony, and allow me to repeat our firm support for 2710 as amended.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Brent with League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The League of Oregon Cities has had a conversation around this issue during the 2016 process that we use of bringing together various policy committees to talk about potential legislative priorities. And the LOC Energy Policy Committee came together and had a lot of conversations about this issue. I can say today that we are very supportive of moving back to a three-year review period for the energy efficiency code. My understanding is that we moved to a six-year code review, and we would support the notion of moving back to that three-year update, just to make sure that we're staying current with technologies and standards. And what really brought about the conversation was that the chair of our policy committee is from City of Corvallis. And what he had indicated to us was a concern over some new housing that had gone in the city of Corvallis, brand new university housing, and complaints that they had received from students who had cadet heating systems and were not able to turn those on because of the high energy costs associated with the heat. And so that was, you know, brought about a conversation of where are we at on our energy efficiency code, how often do we update it. And it was at that time that it came to our attention that we had moved to a six-year code update, even though it's been relatively recently. I will note that we are still gathering feedback on the Dash 2 amendments. I believe there could be some fiscal impacts associated with Section 2 of the Dash 2s. So we are certainly interested in having ongoing conversations, working with the chair on the feedback that we do receive to make sure that what we're doing is striking that right balance of cost effectiveness and making sure that we're staying up to date and relevant in our energy code updates. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much, folks. Okay, last panel. John Jensen, Tim Frew, and Janet Gastelum. Whoever's ready to go first.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. My name is John Jensen. I represent IBEW Local 48. We're an electoral union that represents 3,500 workers in the electrical industry in the Portland metropolitan region. First of all, our members are really grateful for the opportunity to install the most efficient, best building services we possibly can. We appreciate that opportunity. We appreciate your work here in trying to make it the most efficient. We are standing here today united with our industry in opposition to this bill. We do feel that this isn't the most effective, efficient way, and we would ask you to refer this to the boards for the best adoption of the best practices possible.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Climate Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here in support of the bill, and as many of us know, buildings consume a lot of energy, both electricity and natural gas. And when we're thinking about hitting our long-term climate goals, it's very important that we increase the efficiency of our buildings. Homes that are built today will stay with us for decades, even centuries. I live in a home that's almost 100 years old, and retrofitting a home is expensive, it's costly, and it's hard to do. We have two little kids running around. We're paying, you know, $30,000 a year almost for childcare expenses. And so retrofitting is hard for families to do. If we build right for the first time, it really helps families out. Similarly, I support the provisions for EV-ready housing. Just like we wouldn't build homes today without electrical outlets on the interior, we should be building for electrified transportation into the future. Again, that's a convenience thing. It really helps people, and we know that transportation is evolving. What strikes me today is that Oregon really has a tremendous asset in both the workforce that really builds homes. We have processes that help us get to good outcomes. And what I'm struck with today is that we should really think about a collaborative process and approach to use the existing process that we have in place today to get to these long-term outcomes. We need these higher efficiency standards across the board, but it is right that they be written in a clear and proper way. And so I'm really open to thinking about how we collaboratively get to the end goals outlined in 2710 and the Dash 2s. We would really look forward to a collaborative approach with everyone who's in the room, and think that, you know, when stakeholders come together, we have good outcomes. We've done it in the past. That's why Oregon was always ranked highly on energy efficiency. But, you know, we've slipped. 2016 was the first time the ACEEE didn't put Oregon in its top tier of energy efficiency standards. And so we need to think about how we can keep doing better and moving forward. And I also just want to clear up that the bill doesn't require that we control occupant behavior. It's really about the building envelope and the energy structures, the energy systems. And then it does leave code development to the existing boards. It just sets the goal and the outcome for where we should be in the long term. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. We look forward to, again, a collaborative process that can get us across the finish line. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Tim Frew, Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building Trades. I'm also on the Elevator and Electrical Board, also on the Construction Industry Energy Board. Oregon has long been a leader on energy efficiency issues. Oregon was the first state to adopt a solar code, and later this month, we expect to adopt one of the first EV standards in the country for residential properties. We can and should be on the cutting edge, and we can do more faster. But there is a process. We have boards with some really smart people who are willing to give up their time to help us do these things right. They know the industry and where there's room to gain efficiencies in a cost-effective way, and in a way that uses technologies we know will work in our state, our climates, etc. The Construction Industry Energy Board evaluates and approves or disapproves proposed state building code standards and administrative rules relating to the energy use and energy efficiency aspects of the electrical, structural, prefabricated structure, and low-rise residential specialty. The proposed standards evaluated by the board may include energy conserving technology, construction methods, products, and materials. The board members are made up of two members selected by the building code structures, two members of the elevator and electrical board, two members of the mechanical board, two members of the residential and manufactured structures board, two members of the state plumbing board, and one member of the Department of Energy. The Construction Industry Energy Board can take this work on, so we ask all stakeholders to please come and work with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any final questions? One? Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you, Chair Helm. So I just wanted to ask you, do you know where Oregon's energy efficiency codes are compared to the rest of the 49 other states?
Well, I think previous testimony said that we were behind California, Washington. We started to slip behind Utah and even Alabama. We used to be in the top tier. We were kind of an innovator, but I think we've been resting on our laurels a little bit, and especially slipping back to a six-year code cycle. So I think if we move back to the three-year code cycle and actually put in place those 2032 targets outlined in the bill, we'd be at the forefront of the pack again.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony today. Appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2710. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2020 and invite Representative Holvey to present. And I think we're inviting Senator Olson. We're going to get Senator Olson here. And can I also invite Mike Kaplan? Can you come on up, Mike? I don't know why we have four up there, but.
Senator Olson's testifying in 2020.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Thanks a lot for allowing the testimony on House Bill 2020 today. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8, South Flint County. House Bill 2020 is sort of a progression. I think I reported a little bit on the ODO Oversight Committee work over the last year looking at the agency. This particular proposal is generally based on the co-chair report, the first co-chair report of October 31st. It has a couple of differences in it, but the general purpose of the bill is to bring in the discussion of climate. We've been hearing a lot of talk about climate, and right now the state of Oregon has a lot of policies, a lot of programs in place that really have not been coordinated, do not have the parameters for when we've achieved success and for what the goals are. So when we do have some of those goals stated in statute, for example, the greenhouse gas emission goals, we've had the Global Warming Commission looking at those goals, but really we don't have a state agency that really is tasked with dealing with these particular issues. So the purpose of House Bill 2020 is to bring in that consideration of climate into the Department of Energy to make sure that when we're looking at programs of energy that we are considering greenhouse gas emissions, that we are considering what our state is doing with their programs, just to make sure that we're well coordinated, that we can answer the questions. This bill does not determine that we're going to have a cap and trade or even a carbon tax, but what it does do is says to our state government, we need to coordinate our agencies that all deal with energy, which is about 80% of greenhouse gas emissions come from energy, so that we have good data, good information. The Department of Energy has long had planning and policy and analysis part of their agency. The agency went through some controversial times over many of the incentive programs that they, were programs that the legislature told them to operate, but without really good parameters on what the goals of those programs were, and really not with the expertise to run loan programs and tax credit programs to have some sort of financial underwriting and oversight to those programs. So this bill does transform the Department of Energy to the Department of Energy and Climate. It puts in place an oversight and advisory board as well to make recommendations to the legislature and to the Department of Energy and Climate as drafted in this bill. The board is a 7-member board. We thought long and hard about who should be on this board. We thought that the energy suppliers in the industry really sort of have a little bit of a conflict, though they have a vital information and expertise that is valuable. We wanted a really balanced, independent board. So we picked an economist, a person from higher education system with expertise in energy and climate. We wanted some of the users who the utilities serve to be represented. So we have someone representing residential energy users and then another industrial or commercial energy user. Also, we wanted a member from the transportation sectors to be on this board, and a member from the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and finally the director of the new Department of Energy and Climate. The bill does abolish the Global Warming Commission. We thought it was duplicative in this mission, and taking those roles and actually putting them into the agency seemed to make sense, so that we could actually have an agency that could take some coordinated efforts in trying to make sure that we're achieving those goals. I note that we've had the greenhouse gas emission goals on our books for quite some time, and I think going into 2015, ahead of the clean to coal bill, we were not meeting those goals. And one of the reasons is we didn't have that connectivity with our programs, our energy programs, our policies, that were really aimed at that as one of the measurements for success. And this bill looks at that. We have also in the bill an interagency coordinating council, and that this bill will need a couple amendments. I think I left just listening to that last panel, maybe I should have the Department of Consumer and Business Services on this group as well for codes, but also the LCDC on this would probably be a good addition to that interagency group to basically make sure that their information, their data is all going to a central place where we can put this together, analyze it, and make progress on and inform decisions in the future about climate and how that relates to our energy future as well. So that's sort of a broad overview of House Bill 2020, and I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. Senator Olson, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm under a little bit of time pressure, and Representative Holvey had about 5 minutes, and I'm hoping that the rest of the panel can have 5 minutes each as well.
Would you like to let the Director of Energy go, because he's on the other side of Mike and my issues?
Sure. Go right ahead, Mr. Kaplan.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you very much for the record, and thank you, Senator Olson. For the record, Michael Kaplan, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2020. The bill addresses some of the thorniest questions that came out of the Joint Oversight Committee that looked at the Department of Energy. Senator Whitsitt, Senator Olson, Senator Beyer, Senator Edwards, Representatives Hack, Vega Peterson, Bence, and Representative Holvey spent more than a year with us looking at our programs, looking at our purpose, trying to evaluate where we should go. The Department of Energy was formed out of the energy crisis in the 1970s and envisioned a future in which resources were depleted and conservation would be necessary for our state. The future has a very different set of circumstances that we use to evaluate energy policy. Energy policy and climate policy are inextricably tied. From my vantage point, we have already had incredibly complex climate policies that have impacted this state, and an ongoing refrain or concern for those debates has been the lack of data and the lack of sophistication of data. I think it's time to have, and this bill envisions that this is the time to have, a conversation about governance and efficacy and efficiency. To that end, 2020 lays out a thoughtful course forward. An advisory board of oversight over the Department of Energy, I believe, is absolutely necessary to our future. a coordinating council that requires state agencies who have climate responsibilities to meet, to talk, to discuss, to provide information to one another is well overdue. A report about what's happening for climate policy within the state with reported metrics to you, what progress are we making, what things are we doing, how is it going, what does it cost, seems like a totally reasonable governance step to take. Beyond that, a proposal about how the state should better align their climate policy, how we can prioritize, also feels like a valuable step that state government is well positioned to take right now, as well as transitioning the Global Warming Commission. The Global Warming Commission has done incredible work led by Angus Duncan, but what he has repeatedly said to me is that they need the resources to carry that work through effectively. I think this bill will bring their work into a department which brings with it all of the resources that are available. All of that is designed to accomplish one thing, a thoughtful and reasonable path forward. We're not on course to reach our greenhouse gas goals, and it seems like you should have a reasonable question of why not, how to prioritize, what different actions to take, how to weigh them against one another, and how to do so while we support Oregon's economy and state moving forward. What tools do we need to make that possible? How should we prioritize? How they should be organized? And ultimately, who will be accountable? Currently, there's no one who you can look to find an answer for why something is or is not happening on climate policy in the state. I think this bill brings us all together to make collaborative decisions. And 2020 is the start of a necessary conversation in the Department of Energy, given that we are now reshaping the agency, we're eliminating our incentive programs, we're in an opportune time in which we have the resources to stand this initial first step up very inexpensively and very quickly. We think now is the time to readjust our mission and to point us forward into the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator, go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Alan Olson. I'm a senator with Senate District 20, and that's the heart of Clackamas County. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2020. I would like to begin the discussion with a definition of a few terms. The first is kinetic energy. Anything that is moving has kinetic energy. As an example, the recording of this hearing is being done by kinetic energy in the form of the electrons moving the recording devices. The second is potential energy. Any body at rest has potential energy. It turns into kinetic energy when it moves. This flashlight right now is potential energy. It's got a battery inside that stores energy. When I turn it on, it becomes kinetic energy. This plastic bag, for instance, is potential energy. You might look at this and say, how could this be potential energy? There's a company in Tigard called Agilis that can turn this into oil, and oil becomes energy. And there are many forms of energy. I just mentioned kinetic energy. There's mechanical energy. There's sound energy. There's thermal energy, chemical energy, electrical energy, gravitational energy, and radiant energy. The sun, which we don't see much of in Oregon, but the sun, just to name a few. These are all forms of energy. It's the ability to make things happen is energy. It moves cars along the roads. It makes airplanes fly. It plays our music. It records this hearing. It heats our houses and lights our homes and offices. Energy drives our economy. Without all forms of energy, we have no economy and therefore no state. That is why we need a Department of Energy. This bill gives little credence to our state's need for energy of all sorts, but instead presses for expanded role of the Department for Climate Change. NASA itself states that, and I quote, climate change is a change in the usual weather found in a place. It also states that weather can change in just a few hours. Climate takes hundreds or even millions of years. They further state that the Earth's climate is always changing. There have been times when Earth's climate has been warmer than it is now. There have been times when it has been cooler. These times can last thousands or millions of years. Many times it has been related that in 2015, we had a very low snowpack on Mount Hood. So how is it that we have an abundance of snow on Mount Hood this year? Is it climate change or is it weather? Just a question. Could the 38 volcanic eruptions we have had around the world since 1980 be a reason for low snowpack on Mount Hood in 2015? The point I'm trying to make is that HB 2020 puts all the emphasis on climate and nothing on seeking new energy forms, new technologies, or new science that would provide Oregon with the clean energies of the future. We are pushing more and more the renewables, but renewables mean electricity, which is a fine energy source, but impractical in many applications. For example, in the January ice storm, not a single kilowatt was generated from solar or wind. Why? Because the panels were covered with snow and the wind wasn't blowing. The dams, which are not considered renewable, natural gas and coal, were there as a baseload. They provided our electricity. We need all forms of energy, including fossil fuels, which will be around for many, many years in the future. Perhaps even nuclear, which we banned, but it is a very clean source of energy with new technologies coming out every day regarding nuclear. Furthermore, the commission makeup is not geared to climate science, but to similarities to other legislation for Odo reconstruction, specifically Senate Bill 908. The current director of Odo has done a very good job of bringing back Odo from the abyss they put themselves in. Poor loan handling with large losses, questionable Betsy expenditures. The agency will not be equipped to handle the rigors of climate change. It should stay in DEQ or perhaps with the Global Warming Commission where it already is. The Department of Energy should be just that, a department that spends its time on energy, all forms and all technologies. I further oppose this legislation for a very simple reason. A joint committee was formed with the sole purpose of evaluating the performance of the current Department of Energy. There were eight people on this panel with the expectations to come together to provide leadership on a new Department of Energy. This is not the consensus bill of that bicameral bipartisan group. This bill once again politicizes the department, which puts them in the position they are in today. The Department of Energy needs to be the resource for all energy types, the leader in all technical information, the purveyor of safety standards at Hanford and for toxics in our state, and the umbrella for FSECs so that the needed energy transmission can be made available in our state. HB 2020 does none of that. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for our panel? We've got a few minutes, and I promise the committee that we'll have more discussion on this bill as well at a later date. Representative Brocksmith.
So, and I'll just let anyone touch this, but Senator, you touched it a little bit, and that is because when we met in my office, we talked about the resurrection, if you will, of the Oregon Department of Energy, and I'm the new kid on the block, so to speak, and so I'm learning as I go. And so I have the same concerns about tasking such a climate project, if you will, when we have differences of opinion on where we need to go there with the agency might not be the best fit when you're just now a new fledgling trying to help yourself as you move forward. But more importantly, my question is, Representative Holby, and again, I'm the new guy, but I often hear through these meetings that we're not meeting the goals. We're not meeting the goals. So I hear that very, you know, a lot. But what I never hear is any discussion on maybe the goals were flawed in the first place. I never hear any conversations about maybe there was a huge overreach with regards to the goals when they were set up. I hear earlier and earlier testimony on the earlier bill that we're trying to do what I perceive is some overreach with regards to not going through the prescribed process of boards and professionals that are not being consulted in regards to updating or upgrading these codes when it regards to energy efficiency. So my question is, again, have we considered that maybe our goals are flawed in the first place?
Well, I'll try to answer that. I don't know if I can, really. I think the legislature previously in previous sessions, maybe 2007, did establish goals that were aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions that were, you know, put in statute. And the Global Warming Commission reports on them from time to time and reported that we are not on track to meet those goals, you know, and largely because nobody's responsible for making sure that we do. And so that that's maybe not a direct answer to your question is, are the goals the right goals or not? I think that's a thing that comes up for debate, and that was debated, and the answer was put into statute. So, you know, I'm sure that's always open to more discussion, and I know there's a lot of other people, including the Global Warming Commission themselves, that have spoken to those goals. So that's about all I have on that.
Thank you.
I don't know if anybody else wants to take a stab at
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah.
One thing that was interesting, and when we established the 1990 goals, I don't know that the group that put the 1990 goals in there really anticipated that we'd have 1.2 million more people in our state. Now, everybody argues the fact that 1.2 million people do not produce CO2 because we're human. But 1.2 million people is going to bring at least 500,000 cars to our state, minimum. And those do produce CO2, and I don't think that was ever taken into effect. And when the governor, Governor Kitzhaber, came out with his 10-year energy plan, his whole goal was to get everybody into electric cars. Well, electric cars are wonderful, but we haven't even come close to meeting that goal in itself with the use of electric cars. And so I don't think that the planning, the thought process that went into our reduction was a true decision that could really be met.
And to be clear, Mr. Chair, I just, you know, do need to comment that, you know, this bill does not weaken the Department of Energy's task around affordable, reliable energy. That remains with the department, and it also keeps in place the FSEC process and, it, you know, the Hanford board oversight as well. So, you know, the bill, if looked at narrowly, you know, exists in a whole host of statutes around 469, which deal with a lot of energy that's remaining part of the Department of Energy under this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for bringing this bill, and thanks for the testimony of all three of you today. Thanks. That I'm going to recess the public hearing on HB 2020 so that we can, I'm just going to recess that bill. And I want to invite forward Representative Nose, Representative Power, and Representative Kenny Geyer. And I'm opening a public hearing on HB 2669. For folks that are wanting to testify on HB 2020, I'll do my best to get back to you today. Like I said, we'll have another chance to talk about this bill. But there's quite a number of people that are interested in 2669, and I want to be able to, and many of them are from out of town, so I want to get to them. Go right ahead, folks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to go quickly. My name is Rob Nose. For the record, I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is an inner southeastern little part of northeast Portland. And my senator wanted to be here to join us today, Kathleen Taylor, but she's, I think, doing something else in this building and not able to be here. You know, a little over a year ago in my part of Portland, we faced a pretty big crisis when it was discovered that Bullseye Glass, an artisan glass manufacturer in my district, was emitting large amounts of air toxins and had been doing it for a long time. While being one of the premier companies in the world for this sort of thing, they are considered a small manufacturer and were not subject to EPA Title V emission standards. And thus, they went about all of this for a long time without the community really knowing. The chemicals, or rather the heavy metals that they were using to help get the glass its color, could not be seen or smelt by people in my district. And the way we found out about these emissions was because of a moss study that was done by the U.S. Forestry Service. The Forestry Service was able to figure out what chemicals were being stored by the moss hanging from trees, and based on this study, they made an educated guess and worked with DEQ to place monitors that proved correct about where these chemicals, or rather these heavy metals, were coming from. And then this process started something that seemed like constant headlines in my district for months, as well as across our state, about industrial emitters and what they're putting in the air. I mean, after all, there's a preschool that sits across the street from where all these chemicals are being emitted. Cleveland High School and some other schools are not that far away. And while this was a terrible crisis, it did help to shed a light on air quality in Oregon and what we are doing, or rather more like what we are not doing. This whole situation really got our governor to get the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Environmental Quality to work together to kick off Clean Air Oregon and to work on setting up a regulatory framework for changes focused on health, not industry, and what improvements were needed immediately versus a long-term solution with regard to industrial pollutants. So here's where House Bill 2669 comes in. If Portland or Multnomah County had been using the reporting process that the city of Eugene has been using and the statutes that this bill is attempting to improve upon, we might have had a handle, in fact, we would have had a handle on what Bullseye Glass was doing, and we would not have needed a Moss study to figure out how to get started on cleaning up our air. All House Bill 2669 does is set up a better framework for the local toxics reporting program in Eugene, and then potentially in my community in Portland or Multnomah County if they want to try this approach. I don't believe it has a large fiscal impact, if any, because fees fund the program. In fact, part of the bill is about making it so that the fees can go up a little so that the costs of the program in Eugene are better covered. In closing, I believe House Bill 2669 is a great bill and that it helps industry understand how much and what exactly they're emitting. And most importantly, it will create a transparency for Oregonians in our state's industrial sectors so that we know what's being emitted. I think we all deserve the chance to protect ourselves from chemicals and know what we are breathing every day, and having information will help us to do that. And I thank the committee for taking time to hear this bill, and I hope you will pass it.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Karin Power. I represent Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. My district is home to several large manufacturing industries, including precision cast parts. When news about Moss data revealing elevated levels of toxic air pollutants hit the press, members of our community understandably panicked. I was a Milwaukee City Councilor at the time, and as a local government official, I was in the dark as much as everyone else. In Milwaukee, we have an open public comment period during every city council meeting. Dozens of Portland and Milwaukee residents crammed into our chambers and overflow room. We heard hours of public testimony, including from longtime residents, precision cast parts workers themselves, and parents who were afraid to let their kids play outside in dangerous air conditions. We were proactive about inviting DEQ to come share what was going on, but it was challenging for us to get information because it wasn't very publicly accessible. The community took up the work of organizing, researching, and advocating for improved air quality and improved access to information. There were many unanswered questions and a sense of frustration and disbelief when community members learned that Oregon does not always monitor air and water for pollution and emissions of toxic chemicals. After incidents this big, people want to know that they can trust their government. They want to see transparency in reporting and want tangible proof that state and local agencies are addressing the improvements that need to be made so that it's safe for their kids to play outside. HB 2669 allows local jurisdictions to choose to collect data about what is happening in their local environment. It provides an opportunity for residents to engage with health officials to get factual information using materials balancing reporting and looking at multiple pollution streams. The bill would make pollution reports available to the public on an easily accessible website, which is critical for establishing community trust, and exempt pollution quantities that pose no risk to public health or the environment. And it would be funded by industries with reasonable cost caps. Oregonians have a right to information about where they live and how environmental factors may impact their health. And community advocates have demonstrated a significant public information gap that HB 2669 would resolve. I hope that as you listen to and review the testimony in support of the bill, you will see how important this is. Colleagues, I urge you to support HB 2669. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, and the rest of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. And I was involved in the same way that my colleagues were involved last year. My district sits very close to precision cast parts, so I have a lot of workers from my district that work there. And then a lot of students from my district go to Cleveland High School. In fact, both my own sons went to Cleveland High School, which was near Bullseye Glass. So I was very much caught up in this as well, and as some of you know, I've worked a lot on trying to reduce toxics in our air and water and products, and so I'm really delighted to have worked with my colleagues here as well as Senator Kathleen Taylor on this issue. At the same time that this was happening, DEQ got into really high gear with a lot of pushing from the public and started a rulemaking process to try to deal with industrial toxics and air toxics, and we know that process is ongoing and is going to take a couple of years. So it really highlighted, well, while communities have to wait for a statewide process to come up with some statewide increased focus on health and risk-based ways to assess, because before it was all on equipment as opposed to a health risk assessment, we wanted to make sure that we had all the tools available for local governments who wanted to do more. And so you will be hearing more about the Eugene Right to Know program that's been operating for a long time. There is a statute that already deals with this. You'll hear about some of the history on that too. But what we wanted to do with this bill is to make that law that is currently in place that allows local governments to operate a Right to Know program to have a little bit more flexibility. So two of the main things that this bill does, one is it increases the cap on the fee from $2,000 to $10,000. In part, that's to ensure that local government can fund their local staff to do this work and to be able to put it up on the website and make it publicly available. But it's also really fairness, because if you've got a very small producer and then you've got something like an Intel, it's not really fair that they're all capped at the same 2,000 level. The second is that we wanted more flexibility on how those fees are based. Right now, Eugene uses it based on the number of FTE, and we wanted it to be more flexible and to be able to consider what the output of toxic chemicals are, which I would argue is a more fair way to evaluate it anyway. So in Eugene, they use a simple computer program which handles all the calculations for the involved companies, and this helps to ensure that the public is made aware of the presence of potentially harmful chemicals. I'm really delighted to be working on this, and I hope that you will pass this bill.
Any questions for our panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for either of you, but yes, you do know there's a statewide effort on the part of DEQ to come up with a solution. So I just think in the interest of time, we have to launch into an effort that's more of a patchwork or piecemeal rather than wait for the comprehensive effort that I would hope would be based on data and a lot of good findings and so forth, where perhaps, on certain issues regarding diesel emissions, wood smoke, we kind of have good data that allows us to make decisions. But to me, it just seems like, I understand you come from neighborhoods that are impacted. We all have constituent interests, but I guess from my perspective, we have really bright folks at the agency that are taking a comprehensive look at this, and it just seems better to just wait until we can have something that applies equally to everybody rather than just kind of going forward with something that might address constituents behind you.
So I'll take the first crack at that. Thank you. And I think that Representative Nose wants to answer this too. So we know that if you pass a bill like this, and if a local entity wants to do something like this, it's going to take a long time. So by the time the results come out from that two-year process, it's already been in process for about a year, they'll know they'll have some kind of assurance about what things are judged and what aren't. My understanding of the DEQ process right now is that it's looking at what the emissions for the air toxics are, whereas this program actually, and I know that there's going to be people who operate that program who can answer more of the technical questions, but what they really do is they measure all of the inputs and all the outputs. So what chemicals might be released into the air, but also what go to the landfill, what go to, go out in products. It's a much more thorough review. I know that there are people in the rulemaking process and when there's public input, that are trying to make sure that the program, that the rulemaking that DEQ is doing, would go to more than just air emissions. They're hoping that it'll go more in that direction, but they don't know yet. And I think the other piece that people are concerned with the rulemaking process is how much transparency is there going to be and how much information back to people. And so we won't know that until the rulemaking process finishes, and so we just think that local government should have the option. And in fact, they do. I mean, they do currently have that option. We're just trying to make that program a little more flexible.
What she said, Mr. Chair. She said it really well.
Mm-hmm. Any other? Representative Bent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's just a question. I want to know who's captured by this bill, if that's the right word, or who needs to, if it passes, who needs to be filing the appropriate reports and doing all the work. According to what I'm looking at here, it says that a small quantity generator is a company that releases 220 pounds or more of waste per month, 2,640 pounds per year. So small quantity generators would be captured under this bill. Examples of small quantity generators include dry cleaners, bakeries, dental offices, automotive shops, and many, many more. Is that a misstatement or is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bent, I think folks who work with the program in Eugene, when they come up and testify, could probably answer that question for you better than I could. I think the intent is to capture some of those small utilizers, but I couldn't speak to that so specifically. But, yeah, there is some intent to do that. You want to take a step?
Just very quickly, you'll notice in the bill that it's tied more closely to the type of hazardous substance that they're currently using on the premises. As it currently stands in Oregon law or stands in U.S. code.
The follow-up. Well, all I want, of course, is just an understanding of who's going to be affected by this bill, and perhaps you can share with us what you think the cost would be for one of these small folks to comply with it. Let's assume for a moment that a bakery must comply with it or a dental office. What's the cost, do you think, going to be?
So I'm guessing that someone from the city of Eugene who works with the program can help you answer that, because I don't know, but they can probably tell you based on their experience how they do it.
Thank you.
They're here. I mean, so like ask the question to those folks when they come up, because they work with it all the time.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Representative Kinney-Geyer, and thank you all for your testimony. You mentioned earlier that there's current laws already in place. So what efficiencies does this bill do that?
So basically, there is a right to know law that's already in place, but it's not very flexible in how, and I believe that Lisa Arkin is going to give you some of the history. It was passed a long time ago, and then there were certain restrictions put on it. And some of the things like capping the fees and also saying how fees can be collected have caused it to not be very usable, and that's why in many cases other cities haven't adopted it. And so while cities are looking at what Eugene has done and said, hey, why don't we have that same kind of transparency as Eugene, we wanted to make sure that the law was as flexible as possible.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you so much for bringing us this bill and your testimony today. I'm going to ask up at this time Al Gerard, Lisa Arkin, Bevan Behrens, and Marilyn Konitzer. Welcome. Why don't you just go ahead and start?
Who was fourth on that list? You should let them go first.
Bevan, I understand you need to be on your way soon, so why don't you start?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And I'm starting to put folks on the clock because we're just not going to get done unless I do. So Beth will give you a 15 seconds and then a time's up.
Great. All right. Chair Helm and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Bevan Behrens. I'm the principal and executive director of Bridges Middle School, a local nonprofit school serving kids with learning differences in North Portland. I'm also a mother of four and a resident in the same zip code 97211 as my school, and I've been working in the nonprofit sector serving our most vulnerable citizens for over 20 years. I'm here today because I believe that all Oregonians have the right to know what toxins are being emitted from the businesses in their neighborhoods. I recently learned how urgently this bill is needed. When I learned about toxic emissions happening in the neighborhood of my school, where DEQ has allowed two large companies to go unchecked with no reporting requirements and the removal of toxin cleaning systems that went undocumented largely because there is no reporting requirements. This has been going on for several years, yet our school was made aware of this 2 weeks ago because of the generosity of a neighborhood association that invited us to attend a public meeting held by DEQ. EPA testing done with emergency funding after the public demanded to know what was in the air after the stench of rotten eggs was continuously found in the air of our neighborhood again and again and again. The testing that EPA did in 2015 and 2016 did show four different toxic chemicals in the air at levels above EPA standards for health and safety. DEQ did some follow-up testing to that that did not show the same level. However, the big concern is that we do not know what is going into the air that our students breathe. As I testify now, our parents are opening a letter from me informing them of the situation and of the fact that we were not made aware of this and there is no information out there to be able to inform them longer. It is very important that students with special needs, that schools, that government officials and that government agencies protected, charged with protecting the health of our citizens have the information they need to act and to protect our citizens. I hope that you will all strongly consider passing this bill, and I hope that you all agree that our students and the children of our state are worthy of the right to know.
Mr. Gerard, why don't you follow up? It looks like you have a trip home today, too.
Sure do. My name is Alan Gerard. I'm the Deputy Fire Chief in the Eugene Springfield Fire Department. I serve the public by being the Fire Marshal for both the City of Eugene and Springfield. My office administers the Eugene Toxic Right to Know program. In order to be brief as possible, I'm going to read a letter from Mayor Vinnis from Eugene that pretty much sums up what my testimony was going to be anyways. The City of Eugene supports the passage of HB 2669 with targeted amendments based on our 21-year history of operating our local program. We request provisions in the bill to ensure consistency in data reporting requirements and to reduce the fee cap to $5,000. These efforts will increase the impact of the bill by allowing local agencies and private businesses to do the right thing. HB 2669 is modeled after the City of Eugene Toxic Right to Know program and could modify the reporting structure of the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office Community Right to Know program. In order to minimize reporting duplication for business required to report to both the CR2K program and a local Community Right to Know program, we request that the bill require the statewide program to utilize a common database approach so that both statewide reporting information and the more detailed community program information can utilize the same statewide database. With a common database approach, data reports can be created to meet the need of both the CR2K program and a locally adopted program. HB 2669 proposes a $10,000 maximum fee that can be applied to any single facility. Eugene's experience has found that the current statutory cap of $2,000 creates a regressive fee structure by limiting the amount a large business with more material flow pays to cover the fixed cost of the program. This ultimately increases the cost to smaller businesses with less material flow. The City of Eugene recognizes the financial impact on all businesses of this program and recommends the maximum fee be capped at $5,000 and that the annual per FTE fee be tied to the Portland CPI. Eugene has a robust Toxic Right to Know program that was put into place after a popular vote. We believe communities across the state deserve the same right to know.
Thank you.
I'm Marilyn Kennitzer from Corvallis, chair and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We have lengthy and strong positions on citizens' right to know, resource management, environmental protection, and pollution control. We have 13 pages of this, and so this is a very brief summary. But because of our positions, League strongly supports House Bill 2669. League of Women Voters of Oregon believes the bill before you will greatly benefit Oregonians. The key to the bill is materials balancing. When businesses must report the inputs and outputs of their toxic or harmful chemicals, and that information is publicly available, Oregonians will be exposed to much less leakage and fewer harmful emissions. We've had experiences with this in Corvallis. League of Women Voters believes the bill will have multiple benefits for cities, counties, and their residents, and some of them have been talked to about before by the representatives and senators who introduced the bill. But we were thinking that if Senate Bill 995 doesn't pass, this one would allow cities and counties to collaborate to do a regional database, but I like your idea that it would be a statewide database. But it would be less costly to have it collaborative with other counties and cities. The program is funded by reporters of the toxins. The methods of collection are already in place through local fire marshals and through the DEQ statewide emissions inventory that's now underway. The thresholds for reporting will eliminate the requirement for most small facilities, although toxins are reported by the pound, not by the ton, as is done by DEQ. We can cite many examples where this legislation would have helped local jurisdictions with the TCE issues that you hear about almost every day across the country. Citizens want and need to know what chemicals they're exposed to. They have a right to know. That this bill will enable Oregonians to gain information important to their health. We urge you to strongly urge you to support it. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Arkin, and I represent Beyond Toxics, the statewide environmental health organization. I am also an appointed member of the Governor's Cleaner Air Oregon Policy Advisory Group, and I'm an appointed member and currently serve as chair of the Eugene Toxics Board. Others testifying today will describe the main benefits of House Bill 2669, and I'd like to briefly discuss the history of toxics emissions reporting in Oregon. Our history on the topic of pollution reporting is not stellar. The truth is that in 1999, 18 years ago, House Bill 2431 was enacted over significant objections because it limited the ability of local governments to establish toxics reporting programs. What is now almost a two-decade-old statute is not a law cemented in place for all time. The statute that it amended, ORS 453.370, needs to be updated to reflect our growing scientific understanding of how air pollution harms our health. In fact, Section 4 of the original bill passed in 1999 directed the DEQ to establish a policy advisory group to, and I quote, explore options for enhancing statewide hazardous toxics substance reporting and data collection, close quote, from point source pollution. DEQ did convene national and local experts to form the Oregon Toxics Reporting Advisory Group. They presented their findings to the 71st legislature in the year 2000. Their final report contained many of the aspects being considered in your bill today, House Bill 2669, and recommended toxics reporting and materials balancing systems. Sadly, not one of the advisory group's recommendations aimed at enhancing hazardous and toxics reporting has been implemented in our state. That is exactly why it's important to pass House Bill 2669. The bill removes barriers and preemptions on local governments that were introduced into statute in 1999. We urge legislators to be responsive to communities overburdened by toxic pollution by enthusiastically supporting House Bill 2669. Local governments and their constituents have the right to know about toxic pollution that may impact their neighborhoods. Thank you very much.
Questions for this panel? Representative Rocksmith.
Thank you. Just really, everyone kept on saying that the citizens have the right to know. Do they not? I thought the existing law allows them the right to know.
Oh. So we're asking for amendments to the existing law to make it possible for them to have the right to know. Currently, only in the city of Eugene do people get to exercise their right to know.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chief, The bill talks about all employers with a total output of 1,000 pounds of hazardous substances or more from a single facility during a calendar year to report and so forth. How does that square with what Eugene currently utilizes in terms of who has to comply and who has to provide you with information? Is this a new measure, or is this something that you use to determine who is under your right to know legislation?
That's a modification from our program. Our program requires facilities that are have a stationary facility in the city limits. They employ 10 or more full-time employees. They are engaged in manufacturing, so they follow in those standard industrial classifications, and they have inputs totaling 2,640 pounds.
There's a little modification.
Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Ben.
Thank you. A really interesting concept about which I don't know enough, and I'm just curious, where it's been in play, has it worked?
It works as far as the reporting works with manufacturers. They report to us. We publish the information on a web page so that the public can access it. And I don't know the statistics on how many times we've been our web pages have been accessed, but it's considerable.
I understand that would give someone the right to know, and that would be good.
Yeah.
But I am curious what then happens. Is there a measure of consequences once someone finds out, goes to the web page, what happens next? Now we know something, but I'm just curious if there isn't another step, and that's what we may have heard about earlier, the DEQ coming in or being asked to come in. I just want to know what that next step is. Perhaps we'll hear about it in further testimony.
Perhaps, but what I can tell you is that people access the information, people from the University of Oregon doing graduate study work, people from other countries, they access our information. People in the local community access our information. I know that people who have done that have testified in front of city council and made comment to council during public hearing. But as far as any negative consequences or anything like that, I'm just not aware of that.
Thank you.
I'm going to move along. I think I've got so many folks. Thank you, panel, for being here.
Bring us in.
Oh, thank you.
And committee members, I know that I'm just kept you over a little bit. If you feel the need to leave, go right ahead. I know we're past time, and I've dedicated myself to hearing the rest of the testimony, but I didn't obligate you. So,
thank you. Okay.
I'm going to invite a panel that is in opposition to the bill now: Marcus Baxter, Rich Locke, and Scott Forrest. And whoever's ready to begin, get right to it, please.
Hello, my name is Marcus Baxter. I work for an organic potting soil company in Eugene, Oregon. I'm also a sitting board member on the Toxics Right to Know board in Eugene. I will keep it quick. In spirit, I do very much agree with this bill. I think that hazardous substances should be tracked. Especially the release to the environment, extremely important. I do not feel that this particular bill is the best way to achieve that. I have three reasons for this. First of all, the fee cap is too high. $10,000 is five times what it is in Eugene currently. This is counterproductive to jobs in our community, and also it's counterproductive, in my mind, to the community right to know in general, because if someone is trying to start a business in Eugene and they find out that they need a full-time position, full-time employee to deal with the toxic right to know, as well as $10,000 every year, and for that, they can just go right outside that municipality to Springfield, Junction City, Cottage Grove, right outside the city, they don't have to report. So not only are we discouraging economic growth, we're also not getting participation from companies who would also have to participate. Secondly, the reporting threshold, by dropping it to 2,000 pounds of a total hazardous substance, so that's all your hazardous substances total. 1,000. I think of that in manufacturing terms as half of a pallet. That's 10.5 gallons of bleach. So if a brewery were to use 10.5 gallons of bleach per month, they would then cross that. And the effect of this is that it brings a lot of smaller businesses in, which then raises administrative fees that then they will get exempted. They don't even report. So more admin fee means the reporting companies have to pay more. And then thirdly, it is duplicative. There is a better means, which the Oregon State Fire Marshal has just reporting. If we adapted that to, it's already statewide. They ask for what goes in. They ask for what comes out. If you adapted what the Oregon State Fire Marshal requested, we have a good implemented program that people can't just move right outside the municipality for that. That's not
thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm Scott Forrest. I come from Eugene. I'm in Representative Hovey's neighborhood. And I started Forrest Paint Company, a manufacturer of paint, Eugene, in 1973. Right now we have 120 employees, and we ship paint throughout the United States and the rest of the world. And paints, unfortunately, are made out of chemicals, and we use a number of different chemicals. Right now we report on the toxic right to know, we report on 115 different chemicals. I have an in-house engineer that works for us and works at, it takes him about 3 months to complete the toxic right to know. 3 months of an engineer is like $30,000 or something to create the report. This gentleman's also on the toxic board starting this year. And over the years, we've had four different people serve on the toxic board. Eugene's program actually has been very cooperative between the fire department and industries. And in looking at this bill, there's several things I'd like to point out. The first, along with this gentleman and the mayor of Eugene, was $10,000 is way too much. Right now we pay $2,000 a year. A 500% increase is a little tough to take. The second point I want to pay is the violation fines. In here it says for a violation you'll pay $1,000 a day. Well, what you're going to the way you're going to find a violation is this year our guy who prepares a report picks up and says, oh, it wasn't 115. We should have reported on 120. So we've got five violations times 365 days. That's $365,000 for each violation. And my time is up. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, board. I am going to go to the extreme. I'm a business owner in Eugene. I have a business called Mid Valley Metals. I moved to Eugene from Springfield. Had I known about the toxic right to know, I probably would have changed my mind and moved to Junction City or someplace like that. But I'd just like to tell you that what supports this is not what you really get when it comes to the business. I am what they consider a non-reporter right now. I don't have to report, but I have to pay the same fee as this gentleman here. In 2015, the first time I was assessed, my bill was $2,000, just like he did. I have 30 employees. He has 115. It is not right. The facts about the toxic right to know program in Eugene is that they've been struggling with the fees to support this since the inception. I have read every minute of every meeting that's ever taken place. That's all they talk about, is how to get more fees to expand the program. And now it's fallen onto they created a city ordinance 2189 here in 2000 after the 2431. So which changes it, I think Al Gerard told you 2,660. That's just for reporting. How they assess me my fees is any usage of any chemical on the list over zero. Now, how fair is that?
They have, for somebody who has a business here, they have a one kilo tolerance. I don't even get the tolerance. I've got the rest of all I have to say in this letter. I'll leave it with Holly there.
Very good.
And but they're extorting up to $1 million from people since 2000, and we're 51 non-reporting companies against 30 reporting companies in Eugene. We can't even be represented on the board. They won't allow it. I've asked to be on the board. They won't allow it because they've cherry-picked what they wanted out of the laws and kept what they wanted and passed on everything else.
Thanks. And I go right ahead with that, submitting that testimony. That'll be in our permanent record. Thank you. Thanks, panel. We appreciate you being here.
Hold on.
Representative.
To you and to our testifier here, but you mentioned the Oregon State Fire Marshal has a disclosure program in place statewide, and I wondered if we might just find out more about that, because that's kind of new information.
Yes, we can. Thank you for that question.
That's correct. As does the Eugene Springfield Fire Marshal as well. And it's geared towards more or less making sure that firefighters know what hazardous chemicals are in a building. So if you have a lot of chemicals, you have to go through and say where they're in the building. And they do ask a lot of the same information, how much you bring in, how much you send out. The Eugene Toxics Board, as well as the Eugene Fire Marshal's Hazardous Substance Fee, we have three of them in Eugene that I report to, they're all very good at asking different parts of the same question, which, as someone who does this paperwork, is very frustrating and why I would like to see it consolidated. Statewide, Oregon State Fire Marshal, the thresholds are a little different. I believe it's 500 pounds of any one chemical. If you have 500 pounds, then you have to report that chemical to the Oregon State Fire Marshal. And one thing that I would note, I think in Section 2, Line 11, it states that the hazardous fee would be based on in the in-house bill 2669 would be based on full-time employees as well as output. Well, that is also what the Oregon State Fire Marshal bases their report on, is basically how much you store, which is an output. So I don't know if, I mean, that's maybe slightly different that it's also based on full-time employees, but also fairly duplicative. So.
Yeah, we report on to the fire marshal, but we also report toxic release inventory that covers all of our air pollutions. It's on the EPA site, and we report to Elaine Regional Air Pollution Authority, and we have a storm sewer permit where we have to test the storm sewer and report on what goes out in the sewer. So there's a lot of other reporting besides this going on.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thanks for traveling today to come to the hearing.
I'm going to now invite up Thomas Mashell. Thomas? Is Thomas still here? And before I get the next panel up, for folks that are following HB 2020, I'm going to carry that over both to tomorrow's hearing, evening hearing, and then at that hearing, I'll be carrying 2020 over to the Wednesday hearing. And we'll try to figure out how we're going to get it done then, and stay tuned. It's an important issue that needs a lot more talking about, and I know that, and we'll get to it. But I want to get to these folks that are not in the building every day, like most of you who have signed up for HB 2020. So have a good evening. We'll get back to that bill later this week. So Thomas is here, Jessica Applegate, and Catherine Salzman. Thomas, go right ahead. Why don't you lead us off here?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Mosier on behalf of the Audubon Society of Portland. In the interest of time, I'll just, we support this bill, 2669, and that's it.
Oh, wonderful. Wow. All right. We're back on schedule.
Thank you.
Well done.
All right. Thanks so much, Thomas.
Cheers. Thank you.
All right.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Salzman. I'm a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition. I also am serving as an alternate on the Governor's Clean Air Oregon Advisory Committee. And I've lived in Southeast Portland for 35 years. As has already been noted, because of the bullseye glass thing and the Moss study, what the Moss study revealed, our community has been in crisis. We had a public health crisis and a crisis of knowledge. The Moss study very handily exposed our ignorance. And when I say our, I mean agencies, the public, and industry alike. It revealed how much we don't know about the toxic chemicals that are accumulating around us and inside of us. Had we had something like HB 2669, thank you, but we would have been able to know well in advance what was happening at Bullseye Glass. Community would have been, the fire marshal would have been informed, and the community would have had access to the data. I want to clarify something about Cleaner Air Oregon, because I think people have been hanging their hat on it. It's stationary air toxics only. HB 2669 is full materials balancing, so it gives you information about everything from what is already reported to a fire marshal by law, and then what goes into a product, what goes in the air, what goes in the waste stream, and what is carted off as hazardous waste. So it's a much more comprehensive picture of the toxics that are in the environment. Like the Moss study, it gives you an indication. And it gives you a pretty clear indication. One of the things we're finding in Cleaner Air Oregon is that gathering data about what is actually in the air is tremendously difficult and often very costly. I just want to say that our communities are really desperate for this information. We want this information so that we can make informed, appropriate decisions about how to proceed with our lives, how to care for our families, and how to participate fully in the lives of our community. Thank you very much for hearing our testimony.
Thank you, Chair Helm, and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Applegate, and I reside in Portland, and I also run a small family business in rural Douglas County, so I kind of live in both the city and the rural environment. I'm also an advisory committee member for Cleaner Air Oregon, and I live around Bullseye Glass, and so I really appreciate this, the potential scope of this bill to cover all Oregonians and have that be an option for the municipalities. I was personally affected by underregulated air toxics in the Portland area. One of the rationales against this bill that I've heard is that there are already rules on the books making it redundant. And I'm here to say that the current system, as it stands, it doesn't work. It just didn't protect us in our neighborhood, and it poisoned us for decades. And it also begs the question of who else out there in terms of industry is unregulated. There seems to be a pattern here. In Eugene, regulators partnered with health officials using an asthma study and matched it with what was revealed in that full materials balancing report. This information told regulators where monitors were most needed. We simply can't afford to put a monitor everywhere. And we can't rely solely on the computer modeling as well. The Forest Service Moss study taught us that computer modeling alone doesn't tell us where toxics are coming from, as was with the case with the art glass manufacturers. And it ended up, without that, it's a gigantic game of not it with industry saying, you know, we're not the ones emitting, it's them. And so House Bill 2669 enhances the recent emissions inventory requirement. It creates transparency and cooperation among stakeholders, and it is a complement to Cleaner Air Oregon. It's part of a multi-pronged approach to dealing with these air toxics issues in Oregon. It gives everyone a much-needed option. You can't regulate if you don't know exactly what you are trying to regulate.
Jessica, I need to have you wrap up.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. you said that the current laws aren't effective, and I, having being from the opposite end of the state, followed that issue very closely, and I'm very sorry that the...
We thank you for that. I think you're the first person who's apologized. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We're very sorry that the existing regulations failed you. But have you thought that maybe it was the agency, such as DAQ, that failed to follow up and do its job? I know that I requested information from from DAQ not too long ago for a serious issue that's happening, environmental issue in Central, or I-5 corridor, that I haven't received that information. That was weeks ago. So maybe rather than looking at, can we have a conversation about possibly looking at ways where we can have our agencies do what they're supposed to do?
I would agree, and this I agree with you absolutely. Part of the transparency that this bill offers is that ability to all of us come together and have the same information. When you have a really underfunded DEQ without proper public records, without an archivist, it's absolutely impossible for anyone to have access to this information in real time to protect their own neighborhood. So I think it's a failure in many different areas, and this is going to take a multi-pronged approach. There's some things that need to happen at DEQ, but there's also basic transparency that really needs to happen to restore that public trust that was completely lost.
For example, one of the things we don't know about Cleaner Air Oregon is if that transparency is going to be included. Transparency is really important to the public. We want to know what we're breathing, what's going in the water. We want to know what's going on, so that and have real data about what's happening and what's happening in our communities. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you
for testifying. Going to invite Renee Loveland, Carol Johnston, and Greg Thielen up. And I'll get to these guys.
Chairman Helm and other members, my name's Carol Johnston. I live in Salem, Oregon. I am a Vietnam War veteran. I support House Bill 2669 because what you don't know can hurt you. I experienced this in Vietnam during the war. Unknown to me, I was exposed to a powerful poison called dioxin in Agent Orange. Ignorance of my exposure to the dioxin did not prevent it from causing me to have a tumor grow on my back, develop asthma, and experience negative effects on my digestive system. These had a profound effect on my life. Because of my experience, and because many of us already carry the burdens of previous exposures, I know that we need data. Even as I speak to you, dioxin, as well as many other toxins that have short-term and bioaccumulative effects, are being emitted from smokestacks or washed into our soil and waterways right here in Oregon. As toxic emissions from Portland Art Glass Factories amply demonstrated last year, we often don't know the source of toxic emissions, much less the amounts. We can't even begin to answer questions about their dispersion or health effects because we don't have adequate data. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has inadequate resources to monitor the air throughout the state on a continuous basis. House Bill 2669 could make more efficient use of DEQ's scarce resources by helping communities zero in on potential toxic emission sources. People in local jurisdictions have an intense interest in knowing what might be harmful in the air that they and their children are breathing. Implementing House Bill 2669 will go a long way toward helping them find out. It will also help DEQ focus their efforts to the greatest effect. Regarding the costs that were mentioned by the gentleman from the industries, I'll just point out that the cost of raising a child who's got brain damage probably exceeds the fees that they're going to pay many times over. And if we can prevent those from happening, the dioxin in Vietnam. There was like 150,000 documented birth defects from the dioxin in Vietnam. I mean, we got to pay attention. People in Portland have a right to be angry about their kids being exposed to these toxins. Thank you.
Right. Chair Hellman, the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Greg Thielen. I live in Portland. Others have spoken very eloquently about the situation with Bullseye Glass Company and the toxins that were released there, about how the DEQ knew there were toxins being released into the atmosphere. They could not locate where they were coming from until the MOS study. That's when they put the monitors around the area, and they tuned in that that's where it was coming from. So I lived for 30 years, six blocks away from there. The levels of cadmium were 233 times over the health rate. Levels of arsenic, 159 times the health rate. Hexavalent chromium, 893 times the ABC levels, the safe levels to breathe. My family breathed it, I breathed it, I went for walks. Cadmium, arsenic, and chromium are very dangerous chemicals, cancer-causing. I got this information off the website this morning, the Oregon Health Authority website this morning, these numbers. So that's what I've been breathing for 30 years. I'm mad as hell. I want some changes. I want there to be transparency. I want people to know what we're breathing, what's going in the air, what's going in the water. If it costs a few bucks, I'll even pay in advance. If it costs me something, if it costs me more money to pay for something, fine. I just don't want to have to do it, and I want to know what's happening. I'm in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Lana Butterfield, Mike Freese, Keith Curtis, and Scott Dahlman, come on up. And Heath, if you got to run,
I do.
Why don't you go first?
Wow, is that right? Go ahead. Thank you. Chair Helm, remaining members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm here testifying in opposition to House Bill 2669. A few points on this. I'm not an expert on toxic release inventory reporting. There's actually quite a bit to know about it. And the state fire marshal's efforts here and with the chief in Eugene, they have their own programs, and I don't actually know a lot about those. But what I have done is I've actually read the bill, and my reading of it doesn't line up perfectly with some of the things that have been said earlier. You know, presently, we have a permissive program for a community right to know statute in Oregon. That is to say, local communities can sign up for this program if they want to. And I'm not sure why, but local communities have elected not to do that so far. But this bill does three things to the existing statute. The first thing it does is it eliminates a number of the required findings that a local community must make as a prerequisite to implementing a new program. And it's not clear to me why these are a good idea. For instance, one of the required findings is that a state or federal government does not collect data that will provide substantially the same information desired by the local government. I mean, you could design a program that covers more substances, but then that wouldn't be substantially the same as that collected by the feds, right? It's not clear to me why we would be eliminating language that specifically requires eliminating duplication, right? I don't know if there's a good reason to collect information if it's already mandated elsewhere. I commend the other findings to you. Another one of them is that DEQ, the State Fire Marshal, and the Oregon Health Authority have had an opportunity to comment on the program. That strikes me as just an eminently reasonable thing. I don't know why we would be deleting that. Second, the bill mandates an all-or-nothing, one-size-fits-all reporting requirement. I'd point you to Section 2, Sub 5, and it provides that everybody has to do this mass balance information reporting. If a local community thinks that's overkill, they don't have the opportunity to elect out. There's actually less flexibility in this bill than the current statute. And finally, it quintuples fees. And while that one could style as some flexibility for the local community and that they may have more money at their disposal. It's not been clear to me why that's necessary. And so, again, for those reasons, we oppose the bill. Chair, thank you for letting me go.
Thank you for your testimony, Heath. Whoever wants to go next, go right ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm testifying on behalf of the Pacific Propane Gas Association. Propane is listed as a clean fuel in the Federal Register. It does not cause streams to be polluted when it is released from its tank under pressure. It's a liquid inside the tank, but when it's released, it's a gas and it dissipates in the air. So it is in no way, shape, and form a biopersistent substance. We've been faithfully reporting under the Community Right to Know program. We're not happy about having an increase in reporting duties and in fees when we're not the problem. I'd ask you to narrow this bill and make it persistent to biopersistent substances, not catch propane in its grasp.
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Dahlman, Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. As a reminder, OFS represents farmers, foresters, and other users of pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. Here today speaking in opposition to House Bill 2669 today for the main reason of it being overly broad. We're really worried that it could include distributors of pesticides and fertilizer, so your local distributors, they already report to the state fire marshal for first responder purposes. They are not manufacturers of these products, but they definitely store more than 1,000 pounds of pesticides and fertilizers, which could be included under this. But they store it and then they sell it to a customer who takes it and uses it. There's no manufacturing or emissions per se, but we're worried they could be held to the same requirements. We understand the current reporting, as I said, for the first responders and think that makes sense for those distributors, but don't believe that having this extra reporting and the extra cost of it for a little demonstrable benefit is worth it. We're also worried that it could hit individual farmers as well because of storage of pesticides and fertilizers. They order fertilizer by the ton. You are automatically over 1,000 pounds if you order a ton of fertilizer, which you are then probably that week going to apply over your fields. Yet you could be brought into a program where you are now having complex reporting to do and also up to $10,000 to pay for the program. So with that, I just want to say we are opposed to the bill moving forward, and thank you for your time.
All right, ahead, Mike.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries with Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association here in opposition of House Bill 2669. I provided some testimony for you and really outlines our concerns, and I know there's some others here waiting to testify, so let me be brief. This is not an air toxics issue. I know that that's the conversation that this is being shoehorned into. This is about a program that's currently in place in the city of Eugene. Today, if the city of Portland wanted to implement this program, they could. It's unclear to me from advocates why they need the changes that would remove important public processes and why that's not more, or why that doesn't take away transparency in a program that they're claiming is to provide transparency. It also takes away protections for things that we think are important on for trade secrets. It also reduces the number of pounds that that a manufacturer or a distributor or a business of any kind has to report under. So I think under the current program in Eugene, it's 2,600 pounds down to 1,000. We're not entirely clear why that number was picked. There are some other issues in the bill that we would like to hear some more information around why they're being proposed. In particular, the fee increase from $2,000 to $10,000. We don't know if that was just a number picked out of thin air or if there's actual reason for $10,000 as opposed to $2,000. So with that, I'm happy to take questions and continue conversation around this bill.
Okay. Any questions?
Thanks so much for staying. Appreciate it. I think we have our final two testifiers, Hayden Jones and Laura Berg. Did they have to leave? Is Laura still here? Laura Berg. Okay.
Would you like to go first?
Go first.
Thank you, Chair Helm and the members of the committee. My name is Hayden Jones. I'm 17 years old and I live and go to school in a toxic hotspot in Southeast Portland. I've grown up within half a mile of both Bullseye Glass and a popular traffic route for both diesel trucks and the Reunion Pacific Railroad. If you've ever been to Portland, you'd know that rain is a common occurrence, and I, like many other Portlanders, would be seen outside completely unfazed. Unbeknownst to myself and many others, we were being actively poisoned by toxics and heavy metals in the rain. I am saddened to be able to claim to be a member of the first generation that has to worry about their future, not because of financial or political unrest, but because of environmental instability. HB 2669, the right to know, is not simply a step in the right direction. It's a step in the direction of giving my generation hope in a time where hope is a very scarce resource. The decisions made in this room decide whether or not my generation can thrive. Today, I urge you to value my health, the health of my peers, and the health of the environment over the profits of industry. Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Berg, and I live in Milwaukee, Oregon. I live close enough to Precision Cast Parts to hear the blowers come on at night, so I've lain awake many, many hours listening to the blowers and wondering about what are the chemicals that are coming out of those blowers, and do they have anything to do with all the cancers that are in my neighborhood. I also live near Eastside Plating, which uses nickel, chromium, cadmium, all of which are toxic, and I don't know what other toxic substances they use. Or how much, which is that very information that we need to have available to us so we can make good decisions. McClure Industries is also close by my home. I can smell the styrene that they emit. In 2009, they put out more than 25,000 pounds of styrene and have the potential by their permit to emit 34 tons of styrene per year. Styrene is toxic to the gastrointestinal tract, the kidneys, and the respiratory system. And I'm wondering if the asthma that I've developed in the last 9 years of living in this neighborhood is attributable to breathing styrene day in and day out. All we're asking with this bill is that industry be good neighbors. Whatever they're emitting, we're all breathing. And it's only with accurate information that we can make wise decisions for our human health and the health of the environment. I am acutely aware of the need for good jobs in Oregon, but trading our health for a few jobs is not smart. I'm confident that we can create a robust and clean economy starting with bills like the Toxics Right to Know Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these folks? Okay. Thanks for coming to testify today. I appreciate it. And with that, I think we will close the public hearing on HB 2669, and I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy and Environment. And I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy and